This conference will.
You had to get the recording going. All right, so let's talk about Leading with a Limp. This is a great little book that, again, somebody in my organization blessed me with. I will highlight to all of you. I know we're not necessarily all of the same religious walk, or some people choose not to have any religion in their life at all. But I do want to bring up the point that this book is written, it's a strong Christian bent to it, so if you want to get it, that's what you're going to walk yourself into. I don't think that that should stop anyone who's not a Christian from reading the book, because it's an awesome book just from a perspective of leadership and gives you a really different perspective. And that's one of the things I enjoyed so immensely about this book, that Dan Allender really opened up for me a different perspective in looking at leadership and what we're all involved in, and our commitments that we make as we jump into the leadership role. Again, apologize throughout the call today if you hear me coughing or hacking a little bit. I'll do the best I can. And drink a lot of water. So, okay, so let's talk about leading with a limp, and that's what this book is about. It's if you're a leader, you're in the battle for your life. He talks about leadership in and of itself never comes easy, because you have so many things out there like coming against you. In leadership roles, our enemies outnumber our allies. The terrain keeps shifting under our feet. This is just language that he uses to suggest that leaders, you know, it's a tough role. And I kind of look at leaders as a must. I mean, if we really want to make a difference in the world, we all need to step into leadership. And I will suggest to all of you that whether you perceive yourself as a leader or a follower, whatever you perceive yourself as, think twice, because no matter what you're doing today, every one of you have led a leadership role, whether it's leading your family, whether it's leading a neighborhood, whether it's leading or with a spousal relationship, whether it's leading, you know, in siblings. We all play leadership roles throughout our lives, even though they may not be president of the United States. So, you know, follow me? So some of us have misperceptions about what leadership is about, but I don't think anyone walks on this earth without leading. Some of us step up and do more in that leadership realm, but that's, you know, we're more driven perhaps to do that, or, you know, people who tend to step into leadership too are anxious to affect change. We want things to be different. And the only way we can, you know, being a follower isn't necessarily going to make things different. We want to play an active role in making a difference and bringing on change. But again, we're all leaders, so to look at yourself as if this book applies to every single one of us, no matter how extensive a role we may have chosen in terms of leading. He talks about leadership as it is an extremity that you meet not only yourself. Okay, so not only through leadership do we find out more about ourselves, which is absolutely true, because why do you find out more about yourself? Because you're pushing yourself against barriers and outside of the comfort zone into areas that you've never been exposed to before. And as we go into areas of new exposure for ourselves, that's where a lot of growth occurs, that we really get to see ourselves. We see ourselves in the mirror. We see ourselves reflected. Leaders tend to put more time and energy around self-development because they're trying to improve themselves in their leadership role, so there's more exposure to that as well. But more important, as he puts in the book, is that you know, we get to know the God who's written our life, you know, and that's where we really excel. Because we have to dig deep, because we find out as we lead, we see our own inadequacies come up in a huge way. If you sit back in your comfort zone, you really don't have to grapple with your inadequacies. When you push yourself out as a leader and put yourself out in that outside the box, and you put yourselves out in that area of risk, that's what outside the box is for a lot of people, it's taking risks, that's when you really come up against fears and inadequacies and you know, I'm not enough, all those issues to pop up, and then, you know, that relationship with the Lord really grows in an immense way, because the dependency on the Lord, you really start getting it, that He's in control, you're not. And when we have our greatest needs, like he says here, we have our closest relationship with God. And that's really what transpires when we put ourselves out to be something greater than what we may have perceived ourselves to be. I like the quote in the book that said, if you want to love God and others, and if you long to live your life now for the sake of eternity, then there's nothing better than being a leader. I love that quote. If you look under 1C, you can just highlight that. It's just a great, great quote out of the book. Probably one of my favorites in reading the whole book. The assumption behind the book is this: to the degree you face and name and deal with your failures as a leader, to that same extent, you will create an environment conducive to growing and retaining productive and committed colleagues. And this is really intriguing because we usually don't talk about addressing or dealing with our failures. I mean, you know, when people talk about leadership, they talk about leadership characteristics, and we always deal with all the positive leadership characteristics. We don't talk about the inadequacies that we have as leader. And that's the whole concept, this book. That's why it's called Leading with a Limp, because we all have inadequacies. And it's the degree with which we're honest and open and being able to grapple with those inadequacies, that's what's going to make us the greatest of all leaders. And so it's a concept that is inconsistent with a lot of theory out there about how to lead, or fake it till you make it, or the kind of stuff that we see a lot of. We see it in network marketing, but we also see it in outside of network marketing as well. It's part of our society. It's kind of putting this facade on that we are stronger than who we are. We're playing a game. We're being somebody other than who we are when we step into leadership, because we want to make sure that the people around us follow us, and we have a perception of what that needs to look like. We have people around us training us to how to behave and what to say and what to wear and all these kind of. I mean, it's kind of like it's a whole, like, almost drama. It's almost like a play or a game we play as leaders. And this book is all about that the facade is what destroys our leadership. And it's a paradox that the more we play the facade, the worse a leader we are. So it's a neat way of looking at it. In fact, he talks about the paradox of leading. He says, to the degree you attempt to hide your weaknesses, the more you will need to those who you lead, the more insecure you become and the more rigidity you will impose. This is huge. So as we try to mask our weaknesses or overcome the weaknesses by putting on airs and avoiding them, playing the avoidance game, the reality is that we will need to exert more control over people we lead, because we are not being able to be as honest and open as possible. So we need more control. And the more control we need, it means we're going to be more rigid about how we approach it. And then what happens is that we become insecure. And all of this net result is that people will learn not to respect us, and we will end up losing the best people that we have surrounded around us. And I think this is true about, you know, as I was reading this book, I looked at us as leaders in Manatech. Of course, I always relate it back to what this means for us in Manatech. And I think that when you look at some of the leaders in Manatech, and sometimes when we step up and, you know, they talk about fake it till you make it, and they talk about, you know, how to become a leader, all these kind of things, and the big problem is that we're sitting back and we're trying to pretend we're somebody other than who we are. And it's inappropriate for us to do that, because people have a harder time relating to us. It's better for us to be who we are, show the openness and honesty of who we are, and drive that relationship with people around us. And that openness and honesty, that forthrightness, is what really is going to build relationships and cause people to honor you. And the people that, and some people say, well, Mary Jo, that's not true. These big wigs in network marketing, they come in your downline and they want you to be this kingpin. And I said, it doesn't matter what they want you to be. What's important is that you be who you are. And you're always open and willing to learn and grow. And they're going to honor that. And if they don't honor that, then what kind of a atmosphere are you trying to create? Who are you trying to build in your organization? Because if you run down that path, you're always going to be lost, because you're going to be you're going to have to be a dictator. You're going to be hiding from yourself, which is going to cause you to be what? Very insecure, because they might find out about you. And you build all these problems for yourself that you're going to stumble over eventually, if not immediately, and you're going to cause cracks and crevices in your leadership. So the best is to not feign anything, but really be who you are. It's that open, total honest. Because otherwise you'll lose your people, and we see that happen over and over again. Not only in, you know, in the secular world, we see it in church life, we see it in man attack, and it just happens because we're not being who we are. We're trying to be something else, and then we end up in a spiraling downward motion of insecurity, control, rigidity, and failure. The worst reasons to hide, he talks about these in the book, and it's kind of intriguing because we see them come up in networking as well, but he talked about them in the book about fear, that we have fear. That's a reason for us to hide, because that, you know, when you fear something, yeah, most leaders, they want to avoid naming their failures because of fear. They have fear that people won't respect them, or fear that their leadership will be challenged and all this stuff. But paradoxically, when we have the courage to name our fears, that is the time when we gain the greatest confidence and far greater trust from others, because it's that openness and honesty that's going to help establish the trust in relationships. But confronting our fears obviously always involves risk, because we're, again, becoming vulnerable, and vulnerability is a wonderful word. I know I went in search of that word. When I was going through some of my first Clemmer work, I came up there. They mentioned that word to me at Advanced, and I was like, vulnerable. And of course, vulnerable to me always meant, for me, it meant weakness. And yet, it was a whole new perspective for me to understand vulnerability as a strength. And it was a huge transition for me back 10, 12 years ago for me to really understand the asset of vulnerability, because you open yourself up to allow others to pour into you. And people, as a general nature, are going to want to contribute. And so that's, we're born that way. We're built that way. So when you make yourself impenetrable, when you make yourself this monster of a person, there's no way others can contribute to you, and you will cause a disassociation. You'll cause people not to be able to become a part of your life, or to feel a part of you, or to really become as loyal and committed to you as you might want them to be. So idea of vulnerability is gigantic. But again, it involves risk, doesn't it? Vulnerability involves risk, because you're opening yourself up to criticism and commentary, and, you know, people trying to tell you your weakness, you're admitting weakness. But important for us to understand that. Narcissism is another reason, one of the worst reasons to hide. And narcissism, really, it's about, you know, being married to your own image. You know, we know the story about looking into the river and seeing themselves, and that's where narcissism came from. And it, yeah, the word narcissistic, and it's the focus on self really strangles you from any kind of authentic confession. You know, you're driving your own self. You become egotistical, arrogant. It's all these things. The image and ego becomes the most important thing for you, instead of admitting flaws and failure. So through the admission of flaws and failure, again, you grow to be stronger, personal center, and great. You'll have greater peace in your life by doing that. But so narcissism, you want to avoid at all costs. So if you see yourself getting self-centered and focusing on self, I find it easy to transition, because I think that people who focus on self, I think that, in fact, you've probably heard me make the comment from time to time where I said, you know, if we could just start focusing on other people, we would get off this epidemic of Prozac in this country. I mean, we take more antidepressants, like I think the statistic is almost like 5 or 10 times as many, something, I don't remember what the exact statistic, than any other country in the world in terms of percent of population. It's huge. And in Japan, I think it's less than 1% of the population is on antidepressants. And ours is like 40% or something. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's huge. But it's that narcissism, it's that self-central focus that we've gotten on, and self-absorption that we get involved in. So we need to avoid that. We need to focus on others. And if we focus on others, life is going to be a lot happier for us. And then finally, the last one, he said, another reason to hide, addiction, one of the worst reasons to hide is addiction. And it's, you know, it's the addiction of not just substances. We think about that. It could be also behavioral patterns, and it could range from anything, as he mentions, it's sex to alcohol to simple just workaholism. And I go, whoops, you know, first of all, I thought I don't have an addiction. And then when I read that, I was going, well, maybe I get to be a little workaholic. My husband refers to me once in a while that way. But and I dismiss it quickly because, you know, a lot of the work that I do in the mission field and in my foundation and the church work. But that, you know, it's not about God's work. It's just like, it's like overwhelming that you become addicted to work. And when you become addicted to work, what happens? The side effect to that is that you have a loss in relationship. So we want not to fall victim to any addiction, including work addictions, because we risk the things that are most important to us, which are our relationships with people. So anyway, so that was kind of going over the introduction to the book, and hopefully that gave me enough insight that I knew right away I wanted to read the rest of it. Hopefully you too, if you get the opportunity to do that. But we'll run through and look at the rest of the book. He talks about primary leadership challenges and faulty responses versus effective. And what I did for you in this regard is I put on the last page of the outline, you're going to see a couple charts, and these charts are important because they really are the sum and substance of a major percentage of the rest of the book, where he talks about the major leadership challenges that people have. And he suggests it's kind of like a Rubik cube. I mean, you can look at this, the process of limping leadership. It's paradoxical, it's multifaceted, that you almost need a chart to unfold it to see its different ways. But he talks about the challenges, the five major challenges that leadership entails. Crises, you know, because leaders are constantly involved in crises, complexity, betrayal, loneliness, and weariness. These are the five. And then he talks about the five ineffective responses that we have towards these, and then typical effective responses. So we're gonna grapple with all those as we dig into this leadership concept. And the important thing is that when you look at these different things, and they taught me a lot, the idea that when we start doubting ourselves, when we start questioning our own abilities, and some people go, well, why do you question your own abilities? Well, because, you know, we haven't arrived yet. And I love that statement. I always tell people, I said, yeah, I won't have arrived until I'm up in heaven with my, you know, Lord and Savior. That's when I've arrived. But, you know, as I live and walk on this earth, I am always striving to increase my skills and be a better person and a better leader and a better, you know, a better mom, a better aunt, a better, you know, president of my company, a better employer, a better, all these things. I want to be the best I can be while I'm here, so I have a drive to do that. But the idea is that doubting ourselves is a great time, because anytime you start doubting yourself or looking at something, and reading this book caused me to come up with a lot of those doubts, it's a time for growth, because you can draw a little asterisk and you go, okay, I'm going to go back at this and work on this and do some work in this area or work in that area. So doubt is truly the context of surrender. In other words, when we start doubting ourselves, it's like a pinpoint. That's when you want to have journaling. I always tell people that journaling is one of the most effective things, because what it does is when you have those aha moments during the day or you find yourself in doubt, you want to take a note and write something down about it so that you can come back and focus on it later to try to resolve it. And if you have a hard time resolving it, then that's when you get involved with introducing people in your environment to help support you to resolve it. Again, paradoxically, that's a weakness, right? In leadership, that would be viewed as a weakness. But the reality is that unless you show those weaknesses, you're not going to have the strength that you want to have in leading. So it's doubt is a context for surrender. And reluctant leader is not readily seduced by power, pride, or ambition. And Dan Allender, the author, goes through a lot of examples of different leaders. And if you look scripturally, you're going to find a lot of incredible leaders in the Bible and the majority of them did it reluctantly. I mean, and he talked about the reluctant leader. Why is a reluctant leader? He talked about how reluctant leaders, you know, are some of the best possible leaders. And one of the main reasons is that they don't jump into it with this pride and arrogance. They are reluctant because they see their inadequacies. And they're not easily then seduced by power, pride, or ambition. Those are not the things that drive them. They don't aspire to hold power. In fact, they avidly work to give it away. And so that makes them actually a better leader. If you work to give power away, you're empowering other people. This was one of my big issues as I became a leader, and one of the things when I first started my trek on self-development 10 to 12 years ago, it was I looked at how do I empower people? How can I be more effective at empowering people? And again, notice that it was an issue with me, but I really wasn't grappling with all the other issues that surrounded myself. I was aimed at how was I going to effectively work with other people, and soon I found out I needed to work on me first, right? So, but empowerment is huge, and I think that's what a reluctant leader is about. Some of you can look at yourself and say, I've been very reluctant to lead, Mary Jo, and that's what, you know, scripturally and according to Allender, makes you one of the best possible leaders that we can have, because your humility and your lack of aggression or assertion of power or wanting to be, you know, in a powerful role is what's going to help you be one of the best leaders. The other thing that reluctant leaders don't get seduced by is pride, because a reluctant leader typically isn't caught up in the limelight. They don't want that. Pride is contagious, and if you're in the presence of somebody that's pride driven, it begets craving for others for more, you know, power. So it consistently drags onto the other. Pride tends to bring on more power, a demand for more power. Most reluctant leaders are not impressed with either their ability or the results of their labor. That's not what, because they're reluctant to lead in the first place. So it's kind of like a reluctant leader is somebody saying, I'm doing this because I'm being inspired. According to Allender, a lot of us are inspired by God to take on leadership roles, and that's why we step into the roles. It's not because of us. It's not because of who we are. It's because we're being asked by a greater power to step into a leadership role. So pride isn't part of it. And then the third one is ambition, and he talks about ambition. Now, we deal with ambition a lot. In Manatech, we deal with it a lot. We get people to set goals, and we drive people, and we push people, and it's a it's an important part of, you know, what we're taught in terms of how to lead people and all this stuff. But as a leader, sometimes ambitious leaders, we sing the vision and spin the cost. So we kind of, rather than acknowledging what must be sacrificed, ambitious leaders extol the need and benefits of the death march. So we have to be careful about the end justifying the means. Is it really better to burn out than to rust out? It's a big question to ask. So the ambitious leaders tend to push relentlessly to do more. They build bigger organizations, attract more notice, all those kind of things. And so you have to look at what is that ambition all about? Is it driving us? And we don't want to be seduced by ambition. Yes, we want to be driven to create great results, but we want to do it in a methodical basis, and not let ambition be the end all. We got to be careful with ambition, and that's a hard thing. You know, I spent some time reading that, because for me, I've always had a lot of ambition in my life, and looking back at that, there's a lot to be learned. It's not that ambition's bad; it's just unwielding ambition that we start sacrificing things around us, and so. So again, reluctant leaders become some of the best leaders because they're not driven by those three major characteristics. Now, the next part, he talks about the cost of leadership, and now we're going to get into those. The basic, there are five costs that we talk about, and that, you know, he spends most of the rest of the book grappling with. And in order to be a leader, it's necessary first to count the cost of leadership. And what kind of crisis, what kind of cost do we have as leaders? Crisis is one of the things that is always present. And for those of you in your leadership roles, you know that this happens frequently. And crises occur frequently because we're in the midst of always having things around us that, you know, problems occur. And we're looked at leaders, we're the ones that are the problems kind of climb up that ladder to us. They land in our lap as leaders, and you know, it's kind of the eruption of chaos around us. It's a cloudburst that ruins our beautiful days. These are the kind of things that happen to us. And the neat thing about crisis, as he brought about, is crisis is there to remind us that we're fundamentally not in control. And it's an intriguing concept. Instead of us, you know, so many times we get into crisis management and the first thing we do is take total control. And we've already lost the battle. So it's a new way to look at crisis management. And it was fascinating how he approached it in here about it because he looks at crisis as a context for opportunity and growth. So instead of something that causes us to step up and take total control, where we look at it as the opportunity for growth. So a very different approach to crisis management than maybe some of us have been used to in the past. The second issue that a cost of leadership is complexity. And leaders always deal with competing values, demands, and perspectives. In other words, there's always complexity. And so it's about how do we make a decision with the complexity that surrounds us. What is the process we go through to take in the complexity that occurs around us? And that's a huge issue because there's, especially today, because there's so much information out there. And so we'll talk more about that as we get into that chapter. Betrayal, this was fascinating to me as well. Betrayal, if you lead, you're eventually going to serve with people like Judas or Peter. I mean, betrayal is in some form, is always going to arise. In fact, one of his quotes out of his book, he said, betrayal in some form is as sure as the sun rising in the east and setting in the west. So as a leader, there's always going to be some concept of betrayal that occurs. And it's very painful. And some of you have dealt with it in your life in different ways. And it's a loss of relationship, and joy is a fear that it's a loss of relationship and joy, and it's a fear that comes with the friend that becomes your sworn enemy of yours. So it's a real conflict that occurs in our lives, and it always creates agony in some way, shape, or form. So it's not the fact that betrayal is not going to happen, because it's surely going to happen. In fact, in leadership, it occurs more than what we even know. Whenever you put yourself up in a leadership role, or you allow the Lord to guide you in that direction, you're almost guaranteed you're going to suffer more betrayal. And sometimes it's a distraction for people. People say, I don't want to be a leader because I don't want to feel that. I don't want to feel that. And why is it that you get more betrayal as a leader? Because you're making decisions. You're in a decision-making role, and people are going to object to your decisions that you make. So you're going to lose the, you know, because there's different viewpoints, and people are going to, you know, they're going to honor you, and other people are going to show disrespect. They're going to be dishonoring. If you want to see, you know, leadership at its ultimate, we can look at the last couple presidents of the United States, last at least three. I mean, you can look at Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and you can see phenomenal betrayal or phenomenal backlash. I mean, it's we've never shown in my lifetime, I don't remember ever seeing so much disrespect shown for leaders of this country. And I think it's, you know, my husband the other day was talking to me we were talking about something happening in Texas about some people that just, you know, showed no respect for authority. And I said, well, honey, I think it starts at the top. I mean, when you have a nation that no longer respects the president, when we as a country have shown such disrespect for the last, you know, 20 years for who leads our country, I mean, it's really a problem. We're breeding this as a nation and a country, and it's totally contrary to God's word, and it's total. But nonetheless, that's what we've become. You know, pundits and what's on television and all the things that have driven this, it's part of our nation today. I can't fathom that 50 years ago. And maybe it always existed, but surely not at this level, and clearly not at this, you know, publicity level. So we see that betrayal occurs all the time in leadership, and it becomes epidemic when we have it at the level we have it today in this country as well. Loneliness is another problem with leadership, and that's whenever, you know, they talk about the closer to the top you get, the fewer friends you have. And in Washington, D.C., the slogan they have there is, if you want a friend, get a dog. And so we know that because, and why is that true? Because again, leaders have to be at a level, they're choosing to be at a level where they make some tough decisions. And it's, you know, they're the ones that are fighting over the consequences of the decisions and are open to personal criticism by making those decisions. So there's a lot of loneliness at the top. And then the fifth one that he talks about, the major cost of leadership is weariness. And all we've got to do to understand that is look at George Bush and Barack Obama and see how these guys turned totally white when they were in office. I mean, the aging process that occurs from the overwhelming issues that these people deal with on a day in and day out basis is something that I sure don't want. I sure wouldn't want to have to. I have no aspirations for that kind of job because there are just thousands of issues every day, and you're constantly under turmoil around decision-making process with respect to making the best possible decision within your capacity. And it's very wearing, and it's something that all leaders go through at different levels. And then the last thing he talked about in this chapter was talked about the glory, that at times when you're a leader, you end up in glory as well. And glory is the concept that you get acknowledgement. And it's, you know, you do get a little glory here and there, but the fun part that he talked about was that it's so short-lived. I mean, it comes and it goes. It's temporary. It's a brief, fleeting moment. But there is, you know, there is that little light that happens from time to time, and we need to learn how to cherish that as well. And as he goes forward in the book, he talks about failing that matters. It's really us failing, and it's the nothing succeeds like imperfection. And again, going back to the whole concept here, leading with a limp, the idea that we really look at the times of imperfection, at the times of facing our failures, that's when we will grow and become more and develop more committed colleagues around us. So we have to look at our failures as our that's where we succeed. And he talks about taking the greatest risk of all, inviting dialogue, creating a context for story, living with tension and ambiguity, the blessings of chaos in our life in order to have come to resolution. But the idea that we're open to hear, and that's really critical, that we become open to hear and resolve issues and be very, you know, honest with ourselves that we're not capable without the aid of others. And that's leaders don't typically step forward and say, I'm not capable. That's not a typical leadership approach. But in reality, none of us are capable without information and without other people entering our lives and for most of us relying on God to be a part of that process. His quote was, leaders are not born, nor are they trained. They are imagined. I thought that was kind of cute because that's, you know, contrary to a lot of what we've read in the past. And he talks about, in Apostle Paul, he said, the Lord said, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. And that's huge. And that's the reality. My power is made perfect in weakness. And that's, again, leadership with a limp. Weakness is strength. That's the leadership paradox. The leader who fails to face her darkness must live with fear and hypocrisy. The result will be defensiveness. And this is important. If you don't face your darknesses, you're going to end up being very defensive. You're going to become very insecure. And you're going to try to control others. And that's not going to work. A leader must be troubled. How can tomorrow be better than today? They know that only through change can life be what it needs to be versus status quo. A leader must be a visionary, and that's exactly what we all need to take on. And I love this because as I was reading about this, I always thought about Sam Castor a lot, you know, how he fits in this a lot, because he's a very humble man, and that's one of the most attractive aspects of Sam for a lot of people who feel led by him. I know it's something that attracted me. It distracted me when I first met him as a man. In fact, I thought way back in it was 1997, 98. When I first met him, I was so used to the corporate world. When I met Sam, I said, this company doesn't have a chance if this is their CEO, because he was too humble. He was too you know, his nature was so different than what I was used to with a classic CEO. Yet he fits the caliber of what we see here in this book like a T. I mean, he doesn't have any fear showing his weaknesses. He is very humble and he's very directed, but he's also a tremendous visionary. So, and he loves and he listens. He's a great listener. If you ever give a chance, if you ever spend time with him, you'll see that he opens up to all of that. The book talked about emotional intelligence, and I know we just gave a talk on that the other day. So, they talked about being able to hear and see the real issues, and this is emotional intelligence. But he also said it's not just emotional intelligence. It's wisdom together with having some kind of concept of bravado with it. In other words, the willingness to stand up and take the risks and jump into the fray. So it's both the emotional intelligence and the ability to jump in the fray. Because you can't stand back and just have emotional intelligence. You must have the willingness and the courage to be part of the fray. Crisis management. So again, let's go back to those five characteristics that we talked about, crisis that are on that chart that's attached to the outline. And crisis management, crisis involves two major elements, danger and shame. And those are the elements that help distinguish us between a real crisis and a normal problem. And so when you look at crisis management, you're looking at how are you dealing with crisis. It's not the fact that a crisis comes. It's like how are you working around, how are you working with the crisis that comes in your life. And as a leader, we see crises every day. We don't have everything we need. Some people will, the minute a crisis occurs, you realize immediately that you can't resolve it. People that do take control and say, okay, I can resolve this, boom, 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 then they're not open to hear other suggestions. They're not open to understand and see other people's feelings or look at different viewpoints. The most important for us to do when we hit a crisis situation is to gather information. Because if we end up taking on the whole thing ourselves and we mask our own fears around it, we're gonna enter into this sense of shame because we will find out in ourselves that we're not internally capable. So then we play a shame game, and it's a shame that we don't have the tools or the ability to resolve something. And when you get into shame game, you get into blame game, and then that is an escalator of the problem. You can take a crisis and you can multiply it tenfold instead of resolve it. And it talks about shame strips away your confidence and shatters the value that others have placed on you. So it has the exact opposite role when you try to take control. So crisis is a time for danger as well as opportunity, the tipping point to cower in fear or to step forward with courage. And that's the important thing. You want to step forward with courage, but courage meaning the fact that you want to be open to hear. You want to be open to solutions. Here's the tragedy. He writes, power and control are a high-flying trapeze that takes a leader farther and farther above the ground with each swing. The greater his achievements, the harder his let go, but a leader gains true confidence only if he forces himself to let go. So the idea is this as leaders is to let go, to delegate, to get other people's opinions, to secure solutions from other people and to rest upon our own weaknesses, to understand them, to allow others to pour into us, make the best possible decisions. So again, one more time, the more energy we have into having control, the less energy we're going to have, because you can watch leaders that just put a ton of energy into controlling people, and you'll see that that robs them of the energy they need to put in towards working towards a solution. So we need to have confidence. The essence of courage is not an absence of fear. It is the necessary paradox of leadership. Facing the extremity of our helplessness opens the door to the freedom to fight with a strange carelessness and a spirit of furious indifference. It's having the courage to be free to express our helplessness. And that's what opens us up to have more confidence. It's hard to see that because a lot of times our self-confidence is based on what? Our knowledge. We talk about how do you build confidence? Get more knowledge, become more capable, and you'll have ultimate. And in here we're talking about how to build confidence is to be able to address our own helplessness and to be able to be open and honest about our own helplessness. And that's a paradox of leadership, that's when we become the strongest and we grow the greatest and we grow in confidence, because then even with notwithstanding our weaknesses, we're able to accomplish results. and nothing greater than that. Otherwise, we hide, right? If we avoid our weaknesses and we hide from them and we put ourselves out and put a vision out there and a picture for people that we're this incredible strength without acknowledging our weaknesses, then what happens is we become insecure leaders. We have to rely on rigidity and control more, and all of a sudden we create negative results in the long run. Okay, the other four major challenges of leadership, complexity. Today we're overwhelmed by information. Ambiguity arises around us everywhere because there's so much information. And again, we typically evaluate information based on our own set of sunglasses, as Brian Clemmer would say in the book. The author here talks about it as being our own grid, that and our own grid is our past, what's built our judgments, our expectations, our view of things. We've created our own grid based on our past. And again, if we take everything on with our grid and we base all of our resolution based on our own personal grid instead of involving others, we end up forcing our way on other people. We grab onto rigidity again, and we fail to reframe the issue or reframe our way of thinking. And it limits our options and also the implications. So we want to make sure that complexity doesn't overwhelm us and we don't take control from our own grid. We want to open ourselves up to be hearing from multiple counselors, including our enemies. And this is fascinating. In the book, he talks us, we almost want to be foolish. He calls him the leader fool because he knows that solutions are not conventional and obvious ones. Solutions come from outside-the-box thinking. So we want to be able to have 10 people sit around and give their viewpoint and their look at it and then masterfully come to some solution from that. But we need to hear from everybody instead of just applying our own grid. Otherwise, we'll be limited in how we lead. Some of us don't do that. Some of the last people we would go and ask, we would ask solutions from are our enemies, right? And we can see some of this kind of own grid going on in politics, and we can see own grid, you know, when we need to come from solution, when people are so promotional of their own grid and unwilling to waffle or waver or come to a consensus, that's what self-destructive. And we're seeing that going on at the national level. We're seeing it going on at some of the state levels today in politics. You see it a lot. You can see it in your own church. You can see it in your own organizations. You can see it in Manatech. We get stuck in our own grid, and we fail to what? We fail to want to compromise. And it's important that we understand that people have different grids. We all come from different grids. So complexity is a challenge, but we need to look at it from an unconventional perspective, and it's not, the solutions aren't always obvious. Betrayal, again, we talked about this earlier, but he has a whole chapter on it, and I think it's important to understand. He talked about grappling with betrayal because a lot of people carry forward, and this I see in a lot of people because a lot of people have a trust issue. Again, going through Brian's work, Clemmer's work, we saw a lot of trust issues arise in that. And where do trust issues come from? They typically come from past betrayal, abuse, those kind of things. And thus, you've given up on trust. And when you give up on trust, it's incredible how much you've given up in your own life. Our world is about trust. It's about learning how to grapple with betrayal because we know betrayal will always occur. There is no way around betrayal. Now, you can isolate yourself from people and avoid betrayal that way, but then you're not doing God's work and you're not getting anywhere in Manatech and you're not getting anywhere in life because we're here on earth for one reason, and that's relationship. So if we aren't out there building relationships, sure, you might avoid betrayal because you have no relationships, but you're failing as a human being. So the idea is that we know betrayal is going to happen. So first of all, we want to make sure that betrayal that has happened in our past, we release that. So the first step for you as a leader is you've got to look at why am I holding myself back in building relationships because of past betrayals, and I've allowed it to harden my heart. Well, that's giving control to who? Not to God or to you're not in control. You're giving control to another person that wounded you. When I look at, you know, relationships, marriage relationships, I'll never get married again, and I go, wow, look at the control you're giving that person. And people look at me like, what do you mean? And I said, look at how you've allowed them to shape your perspective. You've given them control over the rest of your life. And they hate to hear that because they probably, a lot of them have a lot of hatred or despise towards this prior person in the relationship they're in, and yet they're giving them all this control. So it's fascinating to watch what happens when they start rephrasing that and understanding what they've allowed happen just by a past betrayal. But why is it that leadership always ends up with betrayal? Because when leadership, you're putting yourself out up front, aren't you? You're the one that's making the decisions. You're making tough decisions. There are always going to be people that don't like it and people that like it. So you're automatically going to be putting yourself in a position where you're going to have betrayal. So you need to understand that betrayal is going to be absolute and certain. It's just how are we going to, and an important thing is that how we are going to embrace it and use it for the growth of character. That's the important aspect for us, understanding how to do that. So important for you to really work from a kind and open perspective, consensus builder, bless other people, take the blame for failures, bear the weight and responsibility for fumbling of others, all these things that we need to do in leadership. And look under in chapter, in the six in the outline goes through all those aspects of a non-narcissistic leader and why those are so crucial for us. Loneliness, again, true that it's lonely at the top. Certain decisions only are made by the people at the top, and they have to carry out confidentiality, and thus they create gaps in relationships. Others won't really understand what you're going through unless they have a leadership role themselves, because this is really occurs at the greatest level, at the highest leadership levels. And it's important that that you start, you know, breaking apart alliances that occur within your organization. You can do this in Manatech as well. You can see where alliances occur that undermine leadership, that you get involved in that. And one of the most important ways to do that is demand ultimate honesty. You know, it's not manipulation, it's honesty. You want to remain open to everyone, including those you disagree with and have a conflict with. You want to allow them to be heard. People want to be heard. If you shut them off, if you cut them off, if you go around their back, if you manipulate decisions, you're going to always create problems for yourself. And so you can overcome this loneliness. He talked about loneliness being like a growling stomach. When you have a growling stomach, how do you overcome it? You feed your body. Well, loneliness invites you to take action. It invites you to return to those who are upset with you and those who laugh with you and be a part of the process. And it's hard to understand that. I mean, how many of us want to step into the lion's den? Hard thing, but that's what leadership is about, the ability to do that. And then he talked about weariness, that we get burned out. And this was really fascinating to me, of course, because it hits home, because I stay very busy myself. So I love this chapter, and I'll reread this one over and over again. He says, don't let your burned out, and I don't feel it burned out myself, but I mean, I think people get overly busy. I hear people getting busy all the time. You don't want to let yourself rob you of hope. Need is energizing. We get attracted to that, and then we get overly busy. Once we engage, our bodies suffer stress and exhaustion, so we start suffering the consequences of being very busy. Everything we do leads to new needs and more complexity and chaos. Response is to build boundaries. That's what our response needs to be, building boundaries around it. And here's a comment that he made in here, which is interesting to me. Being busy seems like the opposite of laziness, but in reality is the moral equivalent. That's an incredible concept. Being busy seems like the opposite of laziness, but in reality it is the moral equivalent. A busy person is not so much active as they're lost. Our excessive schedules rob us of our most important relationships. So it's about busyness involves refusing to live with courage and intentionality. These are all huge concepts to understand in our life. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be active. It means what are we leaving out in our life when we stay busy? And, you know, we talk about this in Manatech a lot. I've trained a lot around, are you guys busy or are you effective? You get that there's a huge distinction. Some of us feel like we're doing 8 hours a day in our Manatech business and we haven't signed up an associate in a month, in 2 months. I don't know how you do that. Now, I can guess that you're spending a lot of time on the internet and all this kind of stuff and you're doing all sorts of, but you're not effective. So you have to really start evaluating, what is this busyness all about? Am I really claiming to be in the Manitic business, or am I just keeping busy? Because you're getting frustrated by it, that's clear, because you're creating no results. And how many areas of our life does that happen where we stay busy and create no results? So don't evaluate your life on how busy you are, or make yourself self-importance. Don't drive your self-importance because you stay busy. But look at and evaluate things that you're busy with, and how effective are you? Because any one of us can sign up for 20 clubs and stay busy. But the importance is that we're not doing anything with intentionality. We're doing everything with the concept of being busy. So how do I now realign myself and say, okay, I want to stay in, I want to have intentionality about my life. I want to make better choices, and I want to maximize my effectiveness. So you start, what does that require you to do? It requires you to start analyzing and looking at each and everything that you're involved in your life and saying, okay, am I really being effective here, or is this time that I could be better spent to being more effective or using it more with an intentional approach to wild life? Incredible process. Some of you need to do this today. You need to sit down and outline all the 25 things that you're involved in and say, what am I involved in that is not effective for me? Or for the world, or for my vision for where I'm going with my life, or my goals. And again, get out of that realm. Fatalism is hopeless determinism. Yeah. So it's important for us, again, that we need to continue to have huge hope. And in order to have huge hope, we've got to stay out of weariness and start to stay out of weariness. We've got to stay out of busyness, and we got to start operating our life with courage and intentionality. Those are terrific words. And that's big for me as well, because I tend to get overwhelmed by wanting to help people and support people, and I take on so many projects. And I've got to set boundaries, and I've got to start doing things effectively with courage and intentionality instead of doing 1,000 things. Huge chapter for me, and huge for many of you can relate to that. In fact, some of you, it would be best for you to buy this book just for that one chapter on weariness so you understand what you're doing in your life. And then finally, just he has many other chapters in the book that follow, but they talk about purpose of Olympic leadership. It's to build character, not run an organization. So the idea is that you're consistently, as a leader, a Olympic leader, you're building character. You're not just building character for yourself, but you're also building character in others as you lead from this perspective. It's about maturity, knowing as a leader that your growth has the furthest to go, because as a leader, we're the ones that have the most maturity to grow towards. So it's so that's it, people. Hopefully you enjoyed it. It's a like I said, it's a tremendous book. I'm planning on going back and revisiting it myself in many ways. It opened my eyes to a lot of things about Mary Jo, and I love to do that. I love the growth factor in that, and it's truly a different outlook on leadership, but one that is well-founded, and I think that all of us can learn from and grow from. Okay, any last-minute comments before we... Oh, Lydia's.
Yeah, Mary Jo?
Yeah, Fred.
Yes. I've had a little conversation with Bob Adam, because I did ask the question on a leadership call a week or so ago about the feasibility of a tear sheet regarding... social entrepreneurship and you know, the synthetic vitamins versus our technology to get that message out. And the more I was thinking about it, I thinking the tear sheet might be a very economical, best way of getting our information out to people, as at least a vehicle to do that. And there, Bob's looking at this a little bit. Initially, Sam didn't think it was needed. It was at least I thought, and then they both kind of rethought a little bit more about this. And I just wanted you to know I'm still
working on it.
That we need that help on synthetic vitamins, getting that message out in any way we can. And
those tear
sheets are very cost effective. You get one tear sheet is full color on each side. If you were to go to Staples and get a two-color piece, that's 98 cents.
Yeah, and you got it.
Those tear sheets are just pennies.
Appreciate. I know. Mhm.
Okay. Well, so anyhow,
agree with you. I think they need to have more substance. some of my problems with some of our tear sheets is they don't have enough substance for us.
Yeah, okay.
I also would like to get a tear sheet that has Mana Bears and Phytoburrs both on it as
yes.
products. I think that would be dynamite, but they
right, because we're talking more and more about kids with our
yep,
programs.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we need to beef that up because we really don't have anything about Mana Bears of any any tear sheet on that really.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're talking to those people in Manatech, just
okay.
keep that in the back of your mind.
Will do. Thanks, Fred. I will definitely do that. Thank you, buddy. Yeah.
Oh, hey, one other quick thing. On these tear sheets, like that GI Pro Balance, look
uh-huh.
at that, and you'll see one of the key things they're talking about is the gut, is the immune system in the gut. But a lot of that print is in green ink, and it's hard to read green ink.
Yeah.
Words that are written in green.
Yep, got it.
Okay.
Get that word, B. Thanks, buddy.
And black ink is the easiest to read.
Absolutely. Especially for us as we get a little bit older. Right? All right. Okay. I got it. Thank you, Fred. Anyone else? Any last-minute comments today? Oh, one last thing Lydia just brought up. She wanted to make sure that I told everybody, don't bombard Ben Carson. I mean, we ruined our relationship with Dr. Gwinapari because of what we did after she put her video out there. We posted her video on integrative health. She just got annihilated by people from Manatech. Let's love on Ben Carson and just honor him for his honoring us and his love of our products instead of abusing him with every Tom, Dick, and Harry email. So let's not ruin another relationship for this company. And I just highlight that with you because we tend to be very over-egregious with our approach to people who are in the health field because we're so anxious to have answers to our issues. Well, Ben Carson isn't the guy for you to get answers from. He just happens to be a wonderful doctor who loves Manatech, loves Ambertos, and has done more good for this company than most out there. So just allow him to have the freedom to speak his peace and speak his truth without us having to have to bombard him, okay? And pass that around to your organizations as well so that they don't abuse him. Okay. All right, everybody. You guys have a terrific week. Let's work hard this week. Let's delve into our leadership roles. Let's learn how to be honest, open, authentic, and lead with a limp because I think it's wonderful to understand our own weaknesses and be able to thrive and grow from them and be the best leaders we can by that paradoxical idea that through our weaknesses we grow great strengths and strengthen our own leadership. All right, everybody. Love you all. Have a great week.
Mary Jo,
yes?
One more question. Okay, the focus on that, the book that you just suggested, what was the name of the book?
It's called Leading with a Limp, and it's written by Dan Allender, Allender. And it sounds like you don't have you're not on my Yahoo list. Go to manatrain.net and sign up for my email list, and you'll get the outline for my Monday calls every Monday morning. It automatically go into your email bank each Monday morning if you sign up on manatrain.net. Okay? And you can go there and download the outline for today's call as well. All right, people. Love you all. Have a great week.